European leaders agree on a plan for the future.
But what about a plan for now?
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Adrienne Hill. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It's Tuesday, January 31st.
Coming up, pulling the curtain back on Facebook.
And China has to share its raw materials.
Plus, the growing world of gambling.
Those stories and more just ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
European leaders have agreed on the details of a new treaty that requires countries to balance their budgets and limit their deficits. Now, it's a long-term solution to the continent's debt troubles, but as for the short term, Europe is still in crisis. Just this week, they're waiting for Greece to reach a deal with private creditors so it can get more bailout money. The treaty that was just agreed to in Brussels does nothing to change that, as Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports from London.
The measure imposes German-style fiscal discipline across Europe. The 25 countries signing up will be required by law to balance their budgets. European officials will scrutinise their spending plans, and there'll be hefty fines for countries that let their deficits get out of control. Steve Barrow is a currency analyst with Standard Bank. He says the new rules are welcome, but they only affect the future. They don't tackle the present danger that some European countries may default on their debt.
What they do in the background is try to ensure that this crisis, when it does finally end, doesn't come back again.
News of the treaty deal has certainly not reassured investors. Today they're demanding an unsustainably high return of 21% on loans to the Portuguese government. Two countries in the European Union have refused to sign up to the new treaty. Britain balked through fear of new taxes on its financial centre. And the Czech Republic also rejected the treaty. The Czech president opposes what he sees as an encroachment on his country's national sovereignty. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
The European Union and U.S. have scored a major trade victory over China. The World Trade Organization has ruled that China must immediately drop its system of export taxes and quotas on a range of raw materials. The minerals are essential for the industrial sector, and the trade dispute was one of the most widely watched in years. Marketplace China Bureau Chief Rob Schmitz explains why.
It's not common that bauxite, yellow phosphorus, and fluorspar make international headlines, but the U.S. government says China's illegal export restrictions on these minerals have forced American companies to move their factories to China. Damian Ma is a China analyst at the Eurasia Group. He says the WTO ruling against these types of export taxes was important for an even bigger reason.
Well, I think if you're either the Commerce Department or U.S. trade agencies and you looked at this case, you probably thought it was fairly good news and it could allow you to build a more solid case on rare earths.
Rare earth metals are in everything from iPhones to electric car batteries. China restricts exports of rare earths as well. But there's a problem. China produces 90% of their global supply, a virtual monopoly. Yesterday's WTO ruling means it's just a matter of time before another case is filed against China for rare earth metals. If China loses, that will mean cheaper materials for the tech industry and cheaper prices for any computer product with a battery. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
And for more on where things go from here, we turn now to EU Trade Commissioner Karel de Gucht. Good morning.
Hello, yes.
How will consumers feel the impact of this decision over China's raw mineral exports?
For Europe, it is extremely important that we have free access to raw materials because we don't have them ourselves. Huh? We have little oil and we have almost no raw materials at all. So it's very important for our industry and for our economy to have access to raw materials in a way that are not limited by third states like, for example, China. So this is an extremely important decision.
Now, this ruling, as I understand it, doesn't apply to rare earth minerals that are so important to the tech sector. Do you expect another case against China over those rare earth supplies will be filed soon?
Well, it is completely true, madam, that it's not about the so-called rare earth materials. But we will, of course, ask the Chinese that the principles that underlie this decision would apply to all raw materials, also to rare earth. And if the Chinese are not ready to accept this, then we will be forced to go again to the WTO. So, but first of all, we will try to convince them that these are principles that they should respect for all raw materials, rare earth materials included.
EU Trade Commissioner Karel de Gucht, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
It seems like Starbucks is everywhere. In fact, it doesn't just seem like that, Adrian. It is everywhere. Everywhere. Except India. But that is about to change. From Mumbai, BBC correspondent Needy Dutt reports.
Starbucks says its first store will open in Delhi or Mumbai by September this year. Starbucks lags years behind other major American firms like McDonald's and Domino's Pizza that have already established a strong presence in India. John Culver is the regional president of Starbucks. He says they may be late to India, but for his company, this is the right time.
India is a country that we are not currently in that has one of the largest economies that the world has to offer, and that is growing at an accelerated rate. We see that there is a tremendous opportunity here, both in the short term, but more importantly in the long term. We want to make the right investments that is going to enable us to build this business the right way.
But Starbucks isn't navigating India's coffee market alone. It's teaming up with Indian firm Tata Global Beverages in a joint venture. India's middle class has more money to spend than ever before. With bigger disposable incomes, many millions of people are consuming more branded food and beverage items, particularly from international chains. Sales in India's organized coffee market are estimated to be worth $140 million. And it's the growing purchasing power of brand-conscious Indians that Starbucks is looking to tap into. I'm the BBC's Nidhi Dutt for Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
Florida Republicans cast their votes today in the presidential primary race. The question a lot of voters have got to be pondering, who's the best candidate to fix the economy? And it's the focus of Marketplace's special election coverage. We're calling it the real economy. Our first stop is a state that hasn't faced the same sort of deep recession states like Florida have. Instead, we're headed to Nebraska. It was spared in part because of its dependence on agriculture. It is the Cornhusker state. But for manufacturers there, the last few years haven't been easy. Marketplace's David Gurr reports from one of them in Omaha.
Nebraska is farms and feedlots and home to some big companies like ConAgra Foods and Berkshire Hathaway.
There's a lot of white-collar business, and there has not been a lot of opportunity for manufacturing.
Phil Teggart owns Omaha Steel Castings. It's been here since 1906. It's a foundry, a place that makes big metal parts for construction equipment out of steel heated up to 3,000 degrees.
Think of the toughest job you've ever worked in your life and multiply that times 10.
The place is cold in the winter, hot in the summer. There's just enough light to see that the air is filled with sparkling flints. Teggart bought this company in 2008. Back then, it was selling $25 million worth of parts every year. A few months later, the recession hit.
I kid with a lot of our employees and certainly my wife that I used to drive around looking for a building to jump off of, but there weren't any buildings tall enough in Omaha that I was going to die. I was just going to get hurt real bad.
Companies like Caterpillar decided to reduce inventory during the downturn, and that meant a lot less work for parts suppliers. All of a sudden, Teggart had the toughest job at Omaha Steel Castings. He had to lay off 165 workers. Production manager Henry Sism remembers what those days were like.
Regular employees were working 3 days a week. Salaried were at four. Just trying to make enough to keep the place open.
Everyone took a pay cut, including Teggart.
You know, we all were in it to fight through the downturn.
Construction and Caterpillar have crawled back, and so has Omaha Steel Castings. Today, the foundry has more business because there are fewer competitors. And equipment manufacturers are paying more for parts. Teggart rehired some of the employees he laid off. They're among 8,600 new jobs Nebraska manufacturers added last year. In Omaha, I'm David Gurra for Marketplace.
We got word this morning that home prices were still falling as of November. The S&P Case-Shiller Index says prices dropped in almost all of the cities it surveys. For more, let's bring in our regular Tuesday guest, Julie Niemann. She's an analyst with Smith Moore & Company, and she joins us now from St. Louis. Good morning.
Morning, Jeremy.
So, granted, this is a few months old. This is the index for November. But still, how is it possible that we have not yet reached a bottom in the housing market?
Well, that dismal drone on housing still continues. There are only three cities that saw some kind of uptick. Washington, everybody wants to go to Emerald City, where all the Folding Green is. And then you've got Detroit, where a house and a car are the same price. Fastest land use is really urban farming these days. But in Phoenix, you got rising from the ashes there. Everybody else, though, has the same problem. Record low interest rates, but the banks aren't lending. They won't refinance existing mortgages, and it's very difficult to get new mortgages. So you're going to see more waves of foreclosures happening, and prices are compromised as a result.
And of course, homeowners and banks do not want to take a loss yet. Are they being delusional by sitting around and waiting for the prices to come back up?
Absolutely delusional. People know what they paid for their house, and they want to at least get that out. But it's going to be years before real demand returns, because over 40% of households in seven major cities are single people. Long-term demand may not come back. They don't want that three-bedroom, two-bath American dream. So if you really want to sell your house, you have to mark the price to what the market will bear. And people are still unwilling to do it, as are the banks.
Julie Niemann, analyst with Smith Moore & Company, thanks as always.
You bet.
As soon as this week, Facebook is expected to file papers with the Securities and Exchange Commission to sell stock to the public. A Facebook initial public offering could raise as much as $10 billion, putting the company's valuation at about the same level as McDonald's. But even if you're not planning on buying shares, the IPO will offer something: a peek behind Facebook's mysterious blue curtain. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith reports.
Facebook knows a lot about us. What we like, who our friends are, what our babies and dogs look like. But we don't know very much about Facebook. The Yankee Group's Carl Howe says the company will have to open its books as part of the process of going public.
Are they really making as much money as people think? We've never seen official reported numbers. And we'll also see how its expenses match up against that revenue.
And it's not just profits. Facebook will have to reveal how much it pays executives, who its investors are, as well as legal and business risks the company faces. Brad McCarty is managing editor of The Next Web.
To be able to really peek inside what's going on at Facebook and where the money comes from, it's a really big deal.
Facebook is reportedly valued between $75 and $100 billion. The real value will depend on whether investors like what they see in Facebook's books. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith for Marketplace.
Now to LAX Airport here in Los Angeles, Adrian, where a tourist from the UK was detained for some messages that he sent on Twitter. He tweeted that he was going to, quote, go and destroy America, end quote.
Which sounds pretty intense.
Sounds pretty intense. Well, it turns out when he said that, he meant that he wanted to go get wasted and party in America.
Like, I'm going to go destroy Vegas
I'm go
this weekend.
Destroy America. Yeah, exactly. Well, Homeland Security didn't really care either way. They sent him right back to the UK.
Wow. Take a look at the local newspapers this morning in Omaha, Kansas City, or Lansing, Michigan, and you'll find the same story. A casino is or might be coming to town.
That's right. States across the country have turned to gambling as a way to boost tax revenues and employment in this difficult economy. In today's Midday Extra, we're going to talk about the world of gambling now with one of the industry's big players, Gary Loveman. He's the president and CEO of Caesars Entertainment, and he's with us now from where else? Las Vegas. Good morning.
Good morning, Jeremy.
I want to start with what we all know about casinos, which is that the house always wins. So I'm wondering, why did companies like yours lose money in some quarters last year?
Well, we lost money on an income basis because of the interest associated with the leverage that we put on the company in transactions in prior years. It's not an operating issue. The companies are very healthy and the profit margins are quite good.
Does a weak economy make people gamble less or gamble more? Do you do better in times that are tough or times that are great?
Well, we do better when times are great. A lot of our business comes from customers at the high end, so people who have a substantial amount of liquidity in their personal finances and entertain themselves with gaming. And these are customers whose activity increases when their circumstances are better. It is certainly not a counter-cyclical business. It's not especially cyclical historically, but when people's liquidity is tight, they certainly cut back on what they spend in casinos.
Caesars operates on four continents, which means you've got a great view of the global economy right now. Who is doing best and who's doing worst?
We have a casino in Latin America that services Brazilian clientele. I would suggest it's probably doing the best of all of our facilities. It's a seasonal business. They're in the middle of their peak season right now, and I think the business is generally quite good. As you see numbers released by the various state jurisdictions across the United States, there's quite a bit of variance. The numbers coming out of the Midwest are generally fine. None of these, by the way, are screaming hot numbers. They're a matter of whether they're generally a little up or a little down. But, for example, our New Orleans market has done rather well recently. Some of our Midwest markets in Las Vegas is continuing a trend of improvement.
And what about the worst in the world? Where are you not seeing great stuff happening right now?
Well, the casinos in the UK have had a hard time for quite some time, partly for regulatory reasons, but also because of a weak economy in the UK. And then casinos in Atlantic City have had 39 out of 40 months of revenue declines associated largely with new competition in that area, but also with a weak economy.
So where's the next big place? Where do you want to be?
Well, domestically, we're going to open a big new casino in Cleveland here in just a few months, probably in May. We have one in Cincinnati that's coming in 2013. We've bid on a casino license in Baltimore, which we think will be a very big business, and we hope to be the winner for a license in my hometown of Boston. Then internationally, there are markets we think will open in places like Japan, Taiwan, Vietnam, and Korea over time, and we intend to be active in all those markets.
I have to say, though, when you say Cincinnati, Cleveland, and Baltimore, those don't sound like places that are filled with high-end gamblers to me.
Well, they're filled with lots of gamblers that heretofore haven't had anywhere to go. So these will be markets of considerable size to fill out a network that allows us to service these customers both locally and then also when they come to places like Las Vegas.
All right, I want to ask you about online gambling following this recent ruling from the Justice Department that legalizes a lot of it. How does that affect you?
Well, I think it facilitates the passage of a federal bill that will make internet poker legal in the United States for American companies to offer. And that is a transformational issue for us. You can certainly talk about new geographies for traditional gaming, but the big breakthrough for our industry and for my company will be the movement of our services online. So the Justice Department ruling says that the Wire Act does not forbid states from allowing intrastate poker. So what will happen here in 2012 is that various states will begin to move in that direction if there is not an overarching federal bill. Now, I think there will be an overarching federal bill. I think it will happen this year. At least I'm hopeful that it will. And in the event there is not, then you'll see states like New Jersey, Nevada, potentially California, and others begin to take this on intrastate, which, although not as good a solution, is still a big breakthrough for us.
How do you see people gambling 10 years from now? Are we going to be doing it on our phones or what?
Certainly, people will be doing it on multiple platforms. You see people today involved in social gaming, things like Zynga and products that we offer through social platforms that they play either for fun or for very modest amounts of money. And then I think over time you'll see for-money gaming, especially poker, taking place on mobile platforms, tablets, and computers.
Are you worried that something like Apple, for instance, could start, you know, the iCasino and really change the business and you'll get competitors that you never even thought about?
We have to be vigilant about that. The challenge for people entering this industry is it's a very heavily regulated and very highly licensed industry. So I'm licensed in more gaming jurisdictions than probably any other gaming operator in the world, and it's quite an involved process. I don't suspect that many of these companies will choose to put themselves through that. Instead, they'll have companies that specialize in being gaming operators like us provide those services on their platform, whether that platform is Facebook or one of the Google platforms or an Apple platform.
What do you say to the people who think that there's just a real problem with gambling? It does lead to social problems and that we shouldn't be expanding it in this way.
I think that's absent any evidence to support the argument. This is a business where the vast, vast majority of customers enjoy this form of entertainment safely, and a very small, and by that I mean 1% to 2% of the people who consume this service do so at some harm to themselves or their families. Now, that's not in any way to belittle the consequences of this problem for the individuals that are affected, but it's to suggest that it ought to be treated against that factual backdrop. So the argument that this creates overwhelming social costs is just silly. And as a matter of consistency intellectually, you would certainly not permit adults to consume liquor if you thought that what you needed to do was to balance social costs versus liberty, if that were the argument you wanted to apply in a parallel fashion to gaming.
Just so we don't talk only about gaming, I just want to ask you about something one of your competitors was quoted as saying. He said, "I'm in the entertainment business and I just happen to have a casino." Is that how you see Caesars?
The casino is obviously central to what goes on in our business. We don't operate facilities unless they have a casino in them. But I do view casino entertainment as a form of entertainment that competes with lots of others. So our customers come here to Caesar's Palace. They eat, they shop, they go to shows, they go to the spa, they gamble, they play golf, they do all sorts of things. And it is quite genuinely part of a broader entertainment experience. That's exactly how our customers see it.
What's your game when you go to the casino?
I like sports betting and 21.
Gary Loveman is Chairman, CEO, and President of Caesars Entertainment. He was speaking with us from Las Vegas. Gary Loveman, thanks so much.
Glad to be here, Jeremy.
And finally, Jeremy, a small fishtail, a very, very small fishtail. 400 fishermen competed in a charity ice fishing contest in Michigan over the weekend. The prize for the biggest fish was $3,000, so it was a pretty big purse.
Yeah.
The winning catch, a 4.5-ounce perch.
That was the biggest fish?
That was the only fish. 400 fishermen pulled up one fish all day long. According to the Daily Press of Escanaba, there were other prizes that had to be given away by a random drawing. Not one of those fishing trips you probably go home and brag about.
It was this big, this small. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Adrienne Hill. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
"What is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?"
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.